right. Testing. You hear me? You hear me? No. Am I on now? Yes? Okay, great. Can we stop fiddling with this? If everybody wants to go ahead and take a seat, we're going to get started this evening. I think so. I do not like it being on this side, though, so I'm switching pockets. Yeah, I know. All right, we're going to go ahead and get started this evening, if everyone wants to find a seat. Yeah. Thank you. If you want to turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 7, is it not working?
I just wanted to see here if we can get it. Well, you got it on, right? Can you try twisting it in just a little closer to your mouth, maybe?
Give them a little band.
Yeah, kind of like
that. Better?
Now, adjust it from your ear, kind of like twist it forward a little bit. Maybe that'll help.
Testing? Sound okay? Okay. All right, Luke chapter 7 is where we're going to be this evening. In my original outline, I wrote, the very first thing, good evening, I hope everyone's having a good week so far. And then I was thinking, that's probably a kind of a tone-deaf thing to say right off. So it's been a completely normal week. I can't imagine anyone's distracted by anything tonight. But actually, for all that's happening in our country right now, I hope tonight you can just put that aside, that we can not think about that, that we can think about eternal things tonight.
This is a good distraction.
That's right. This is the best. This isn't the distraction, right? The election is the distraction. Studying the words of God will always bring you more peace and rest than trying to follow this crazy, crazy election. So I just remember that this week, and remember that right now as we're about to study these words. So let's pray for focus and to be fully present in this study tonight before we get started. God, we approach your throne at this time, and we're just so grateful for who you are. We know that you are constant. We know that you are faithful. And we know that when you ask us to heal us, to heal others, that you do it. And that you are always faithful in your promises towards us, God. We ask tonight as we study that you would just help us to not think about anything but you. That you would just consume us in your word, and you would help us to focus solely on this tonight. We praise you because we know you will always be on your throne. And that is such a comforting thought, God. Thank you for everything you give us. In Jesus' good name we pray. Amen. All right, so if you looked at the outline at all, we're going to be talking about the centurions tonight. And my original plan was to talk about all three centurions in the New Testament, which would be the centurion in Luke 7, the centurion at Jesus' cross, and then Cornelius. And then the more I was studying this, I was like, this is probably not such a good idea because we got a lot of talkers. And I'm a talker myself, and so we probably couldn't make it all of it. So my new revised plan is probably to just get through this story tonight. And if we have time, we'll look at the centurion at Jesus' cross, but Cornelius is off the table. So go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 7. That's where we're going to be most of the time. My goal tonight is that you see how similar we are to this centurion. And at first glance, I don't think it's too obvious to see, but I think we'll be able to see it tonight, and how we can learn from his interaction with Christ. So to get started, I think it's pretty important to talk about what a centurion is. So let's see what you guys know. What do you know about centurions in the first century? Yeah, so they're Roman officers, right? They're not Israelites, from what we can tell. They're in the Roman army, And they're in charge of about 100, they call them legionnaires, which is just like your basic soldier. And different reports said like 80 to 100 legionnaires, but that's where you get century from, right? Centurion, 100 years. So they're over roughly about 100 men. So these are relatively influential men in the Roman Empire, and they're not Israelites, like we've said. They're the law enforcement in Israel right now. They're the people that are there to keep the peace. So with that little intro in mind, I guess, let's look at verses 1 through 3 of Luke chapter 7. After he, that is Jesus, had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. So, not much is said yet, but what do you notice about the centurion right away? I think there's already some things that we can glean.
He wasn't a normal holder of servants or slaves, most likely. I mean, the fact that he knows that one of his servants is sick and dying, I think, is fairly noteworthy.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. If we think about all the other stories of Jesus healing someone who is a relative of the person asking, it's usually a blood relative, right? It's Peter's mother-in-law. It's Jairus' daughter. Most of the time, it's people that are very close. But this guy's significant. He's unique in that it's his servant, which I think that says something about him to begin with. Yeah. Yes, sir. Notice verse 3, kind of piggybacking off that. The first words in verse 3, when the centurion heard about Jesus. I think that's a pretty significant phrase. And what does he do right after he hears about Jesus? He asks him to come and heal his servant. So just a quick application for us as we're thinking about that. What is your natural reaction when you hear about Jesus? If we look in Luke chapter 6, just the chapter before, in verses 6 through 11, what do the Pharisees do when they hear about Jesus' healing power and they see it firsthand? Verse 11 says, they're filled with fury and discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. So, I think that's a good application for us, is when we hear sermons, when we read our Bibles, thinking about Jesus' healing power, what is our reaction to that? Yes, sir.
Well, I just got a comment. He got the information here about Jesus from a trusted source, obviously because he believed that he could come to serve.
Yeah, and I do think it's significant. This is Capernaum, where Jesus, it's pretty much Jesus' hometown during his ministry. This is his place of residence during his ministry. So it would kind of be crazy for the centurion to not have heard about Jesus somehow. He's kind of doing miracles all throughout the city and teaching through it. Is Julie trying something? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He's going to the elders who he assumes has control.
Well, perhaps. So that's a good thing to think about. Why do you think, we know the end of the story, we know the reason that the centurion doesn't go to Jesus directly, if you read the whole story, but what might be a reason, what might you infer about the man, if you didn't know the end of the story, sending others to Jesus to make this request instead of going himself? Perhaps. Maybe I'm a little more cynical than that. Sir?
Well, I think he's in a position where he may not personally communicate with anybody that's not in the same state. So he's used to telling people, go do this for me. So I have a sense that he's like, a little like that. Although it contradicts what he says about I'm not really having my home.
Yeah, I would say that's more part of this storytelling that Luke is giving us here, is that first glance, you're almost thinking, this guy is a little uppity. He won't even go to Jesus himself. He'll just send the elders of the Jews to go to Jesus and ask him to come heal his servant. So maybe that's reading into it too much, but I think the point is there that at first glance, you think that's why he's going, and then you find out when Jesus marvels at him saying, I'm not worthy to even see you, that's the reason I didn't come. Maybe that's there.
I think that there's something to the fact that you mentioned in Luke 6 that just, you know, basically a chapter before this, here in Luke 6, the leaders of the Jews are filled with fury when they think about Jesus. They would not have approached Jesus for any reason other than has enough sway that he approaches the elders of the Jews and says,
yeah, who are not Jesus' friends.
They're not Jesus' friends. Whether he knows that or not, I don't know if we know. But they go to Jesus and they plead for Jesus to help this man, which involves all kinds of things of them, one, going to someone who they basically vow as an enemy. Two, this involves the elders of the Jews admitting that he can do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just a chapter before, they were, you know, filled with fury at the idea of Jesus doing miracles.
Yeah.
Here they're pleading for him to use that power on someone else's behalf.
Absolutely. Sir.
Well, I mean, we're not just dealing with the same people all the time. Evidently, when you keep reading, you see that these elders in this town had high regard for this man because of what this man has done for them. Even have, you know, what does it say about? He's the one that built our synagogue. He's worthy. He loves our nation. I mean, these are not the Jerusalem elders. You know, these are people that have a relationship with this foreigner who has some power over them. And this is a special man. I don't know how common that would be, as we've already mentioned, for a centurion to be in this situation, to be that type of person.
Sure. Yeah, Jerry.
If we stop at verse 2, what does that mean? You know, you can value lots of things. The one that foresaw the future and was possessed by demons, she was valued by her masters. You know, it can be any kind of anything value. But as said by others, again, he really cares. There's a genuineness there.
Yeah, and honestly, it makes you think about each one of us in our own lives. How much are you caring about the sick around you? You caring enough to take them to Jesus? That's a really good point for all of us to think about, I think. Yes, Franco.
I think we have to be careful also and realize that this is a letter written to Theophilus. So we have to think, what is Theophilus and why was this written?
Yeah, yeah.
Because we can just take it as a microscope and then just look at this one incident. But if you extrapolate it, you see a bigger picture as to why he picked a centurion, the story of a centurion, to tell this point.
Yes, sir. Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. We definitely have to keep it in context. And I'm hoping to make that point at the end. So, a little ahead of me. That's all right. Any other thoughts on those first three verses? All right, let's do verses 4 and 5. And we've kind of already touched on everything that's there, but and while they came to, and when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built our synagogue." So the elders of the Jews say that he is worthy to have this done for him. They say that he is the one who built their synagogue. He's a friend of the Jews. That's significant in and of itself right there, that he didn't have to do this for them. It's kind of a, it shows his heart in that he decided to help them with the synagogue. And yeah, and he loves our nation. That's pretty significant language. He loves our nation. And then, like Mark said, they plead earnestly with Jesus. It's not just a simple request. It's not like a, hey, if you have time, could you come by? It's, please help this man because of how much he's helped us. Says something to the effect we can have on other people and how that could, while the goal isn't to get your own back scratched, you can kind of see here how the centurion's, you don't want to say karma, but in some ways good deeds came back to help him, and that the elders gave him really nice recommendation. Any other thoughts on verses 4 and 5?
It shows a contrast between other centurions who might be mean and ruthless.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's look at 6 through 8. And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it." So I think there's a lot of meat to unpack here, but let me just hear your thoughts on the centurion's response. What do you guys think about it?
Even though he was a man of authority, he was a humble individual.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest takeaway, I think, of this section is, like we said, we may have thought earlier, it's beneath him to see Jesus face to face, but he's really saying, actually, Jesus, it's beneath you to see me face to face. And that's a pretty significant reversal to think about. The elders of the Jews say that he's worthy to have this done for him. And what does he say? He says, I'm not worthy for you to even come in my house. There are not many individuals in the Gospels that claim or show that they're unworthy in the presence of God. You think about all the people that interacted with Jesus who were actually awestruck by his presence. He's kind of one of these people that he's saying, I can't even be near you because of who you are. Application for us is think about your prayer life. How humble are you? How intimidated are you to approach the throne of God? In some ways you should be bold. In some ways you should be reverent and humble when approaching him. What else do you notice? It shows you, I think this story really shows you how simple faith can be, right? He hears about Jesus, he asks him to heal, and he knows that he can heal him, and that's about it. As compared to a lot of these Jews that are trying to trap him or trying to, you know, scheme their way to get him into tricky situations or whatever, trying some way to prove that he's not God, even though again and again. I just really think about that Luke 6 passage where, like, put yourselves in the Pharisees' shoes. You're literally watching Jesus heal a man's hand. You watch it as it's all gray and shriveled, and then it is full of life and normal again. And your reaction to that is, I'm furious because it was done on the Sabbath. So I think just a good thing for us to think about, absolutely. What else? Yeah.
So the centurion, I don't know if he's seen a miracle or not, but he didn't sit on the fence about Jesus. He made a decision that he believed. And I think that's going to be a good thing to see. He looked at the governor's and prayed to him.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. Sir?
I think there's a principle here when it says he is set under authority and that he understands authority. His position is that he has men under him, not to rule them, but to bring them up. He has total responsibility for them, to care for them in their instruction, in battle. 100% of their well-being is on his shoulders. So that's what he means when he says, I too am set under authority. He has that authority to raise people up.
Yeah, and what does that say about his faith that he says that about Jesus too? That I know you have authority over the sickness of my servant. It's a great point. So what does he have faith in specifically? What does he say in verse 7? Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and he'll be healed. So he has faith in Jesus' words, in God's words. So something good for us to think about, how much faith do you have in the word of God? I think that's a pretty direct application for us here. If God spoke it, I don't have to see him in person. I don't have to hear his voice say it. But as long as I know that he said it, I believe it. What a direct application that is for us today. So when God says things like, I will be with you always to the end of the age, or what we studied on Sunday evening with Barry, Isaiah 62, you shall be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. Do you have the kind of faith that the centurion had here where if God has spoken it, it must be so? Too often I don't have that kind of faith. And I think that's a really good thing for all of us to think about. Somebody, yes, Ms. Sherry.
I think it's worth not immediately noting that this centurion had never met Jesus. He has never actually seen any of his miracles. And he heard about it. And he believed.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a good correlation to us today. We're in the exact same boat. We haven't seen Jesus, but we've heard about him. We got a choice, and we can believe. Yeah.
It's so interesting. I think it's so cool how he says, just like I just say, go to my servants, and it happens. He recognizes Jesus has the same authority, like the, just about the power of his word. How is it that this man, this boy, I don't know, has he ever heard the creation story where he's heard about Jesus or God saying, speaking things into existence? Like, I'm curious how he got the idea that he had that kind of power.
Yeah. Because as far as we can tell, Jesus hasn't done this before, right? And he really doesn't do it again where he speaks words. And, well, I guess he does it with Lazarus. Lazarus, come on out. Lazarus, come on out. But it's interesting that this is the first time he does this kind of miracle, where before, as far as we can tell, power leaves from Jesus when people touch him or he heals them. But I don't know. I guess it's, I think that's a pretty significant thing about it. Sir?
It's certainly not a perfect parallel or hard time. A really great contrast. But I thought it was Naaman.
Dipped in the Jordan?
Absolutely, thank you. So, I think about his attitude and contrast that with the centurion. I think, as we've already mentioned in his article, the text already reveals, I mean, he has a relationship with the Jews. And I think sometimes it's easy to give, I think Barry talks about this some, about it's easy to just bash all the Jews over the head, you know, because of how, you know, how could you be? We look at it with hindsight, we look at it with a complete revelation and say, how could you leave Egypt and slavery and so quickly? I mean, it's so easy to judge them. But there were some good people there. And he saw enough good in these people that he was attracted to them, a Roman.
not just a Roman, but a Roman in authority, and had relationships with them, enough care and concern for them that he was willing to overextend himself to do the things that he did. And so I just think about the relationships that he had developed, and then he hears from these relationships. It's not like, you know, Naaman, who's, well, I'll go try that, and Trump's in there with all his pomp and pride. This man is ordered to be there. He's fulfilling his obligation to be there, but he's also paying attention to the community that he's in. He's becoming a part of that community so that he can rule well, and he's attracted to these people, and he cares for these people. And so they have some credit with him when they talk about things. You know, well, so your servant's sick. Have you heard of Jesus? He's done things that you just would not believe. And that has some credibility with him, I'm sure. I mean, I don't want to read too much into it. But we see they have a close relationship.
No.
Can I interject? When I hear under authority, that means there's somebody over me. I believe that this man, two things that we've already discussed, kind of leads me to believe he thinks there's a Jehovah. And number one was, is he loves the nation. And how did the nation come about? Well, it was Jehovah Abraham and that story. Why would he build them a synagogue? Because, not just because, oh, they need a place to go hang out by the country club. It's because they serve a person that I believe in. I think he already knows Jesus is under somebody else's authority. That he says, I'm under authority and you're under authority. Whatever you're doing, whatever you're able to do, it's because it's a power. And I believe he already thinks it's Jehovah.
Yeah.
He may understand more than the Jews, even some of our apostles.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big point of this, is that he does understand better than even these elders do. Sir Franco.
I think you can see the submission of Christ to God's authority, and these centurion understanding that submission also.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great point. So we've talked a little bit about his faith and humility, and both of those qualities, obviously, we can all try to emulate. It's kind of this beautiful marriage between them that I think we really need to think about. He's got such a balance between his humility and his faith. I like this quote I saw online. It's a little flowery, I guess would be the word I would use. But it's Charles Spurgeon, so that's kind of, he has a lot of flowery quotes. But he said, your faith will not murder your humility will not stab at your faith, but the two will go hand in hand to heaven like a brave brother and a fair sister, the one bold as a lion, the other meek as a dove, the one rejoicing in Jesus, the other blushing itself. So I just think that's a pretty neat thing to think about, especially like the one rejoicing in Jesus, the other blushing itself. This kind of describes the centurion pretty well, in that he's bold and that he asked Jesus for help. I mean, that's a pretty big step to begin with, but he's humble enough that he says, I can't even be near you. So what a good point for us in prayer to think about is, you can be bold enough to approach God's throne and ask him for things and expect that he's going to give you those things in Jesus' name. But you also need to be humble enough to realize that you're not worthy to have those things. Yeah. Any other thoughts on those? Yes, ma'am.
Well, just, you said at the beginning, like, trying to relate to the centurion and how we're kind of like them or not like him, but comparing it to your prayer life, I feel like sometimes we'll get in this habit of saying, like, you know, we'll talk about something crazy that happened in our life or something bad that happened, and we say this phrase of, like, well, I guess all we can do is pray, you know, and it's like, what we can do is pray. And like, that's what the centurion was. He wasn't like, well, I guess I'll see if Jesus can do something about it. Like, he was certain that Jesus could do something about it. And that's where the priority was.
Absolutely. What a great point.
Okay. I think you also see the point that the centurion contrasts his worthiness compared to the worthiness of the Jews on the island. His worthiness was not because he had done all these great things. Looks at Christ and realizes who he truly is.
Absolutely. Yeah, what a great point for us, where other people may laud us for actions we've done in this earthly life, but when compared to God, what are we?
already talked about that a little bit, but I think we could, really think we can overemphasize that the centurion knew about authority, and of course he had it, but he only had it because he was given it. And if the centurion is given authority, he's looking at Jesus and he's seeing Jesus' power. Where did Jesus get that authority? And it gets back to what he was saying. I don't know about the relationship with God. I don't know about the relationship, how much he knew about Jehovah. But I do know that centurion's making a big point about authority. Not just down, but I think it's both ways.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it's not a theological point. You know what I mean? It's just a basic human point, like a logical point where he can see, I don't know everything about your religion, but I can tell that somebody's over you, somebody powerful is over you. And that's a great point about how simple faith is, really. Yes, sir.
Whatever doubts we may have had about his motives or his character, pretty well summed up when Jesus said comment like that about your faith.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So let's go ahead and read those last two verses then, verses 9 and 10. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. And turning to the crowd that followed him, said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. So the thing that draws me to this story is verse 9. I think it's just one of the coolest verses. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. What do other people have in different versions instead of marveled? Amazed? Sorry?
Astonished.
Yeah, surprised is another one. The Greek word there, which we're going into uncharted waters for me, so bear with me. But the Greek word is thaumazuzo, something like that. I should have put it up on the board so you could just read it. But it means to be amazed at, in wonder, astonished, surprised. And I like the last one, to regard with admiration. So this is God in the flesh regarding someone with admiration. It's the same word that is used in Matthew chapter 8 when Jesus calms the storm and the men are astonished at it. So I just want us to grasp fully that Jesus is amazed by this man's response. He says, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And think about how many people he's already met in his lifetime. Not just during his ministry. He's already met a lot of people during his ministry who have come and asked Jesus to heal them of their sicknesses, but he's been alive for 30 years before that. So I think that's pretty neat to think about. Sir?
You've got to realize, too, that Jesus could read your heart. He knew what time of year he was.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus knows what he's going to say, and he knows his heart, and yet he still marvels at it. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, true.
So the point about how this is a letter to Theophilus, I think it's really interesting that the two stories right before this is Jesus, he has a quote, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And then he's like trying to prompt with these questions of what does your heart say? What kind of fruit are you producing? What are you building your house on? Like if you actually have faith, then you'll act in a certain way. And then how interesting that this is the exact next story that he's marveling at this kind of faith.
Yeah.
So if out of the abundance of the heart, your mouth speaks, and these are the words that the centurion speaks, that if you can just say it, it'll be done. And I have that kind of faith. Like, if Jesus does know his heart, what on earth does he have that's abundantly coming out of his heart that not only just the words and the actions that he has causes Jesus to marvel, but what's actually in that man's heart? Heart that causes Jesus to marvel.
Yeah, that's a great point. Mark?
I just think about the negative response that you see, like in Genesis 6, and God repenting that he made man. They're thinking evil continually. And it's just amazing to me when you see, you know, God in the flesh, and not just in the flesh, but God viewing a man like God in heaven viewing Abraham, or what God said to Satan about Job. Considered my servant Job. So he has this type of concern, this type of connection, these types of emotions wrapped up in us, and it's amazing to me to see Jesus respond like he's grieving over, with compassion over the sorrow of losing someone, even though he knew he would heal him. And, you know, able to see the end from the beginning, he is, because he is God, but just his response to someone who has this kind of faith, and it makes me think about myself and how many times I've disappointed him and had him look down at me and say, I know you can do better than that, and I, you know, and then think about this situation and think, when I do conquer something, when I do turn to him and not turn to things in the world, how he feels about me. I don't deserve for that type of response, but he has that type of response.
Yeah, I think that's a great segue into that. So Jesus marvels at someone else's faith one other time in the Gospels. Anybody know where that is?
I do. I was going to say, you don't know about me yet, but I'm kind of wordy, especially when in the Bible we find the use of the word either one time. That kind of piques my interest, why God didn't choose the word one time. Jesus only marvels one other place, and that's when he marvels at the unbelief of the Jews in Nazareth. Says he marvels at their disbelief.
And what can he not do because of that?
Let you answer your own question. I'm not done with my point. So I just look at that. I think with those two contrasts and what caused Jesus to marvel, one was faith and one was lack of faith. And how astonished, think about it, he's astonished at this man's faith. I would have felt about those Jews in Nazareth. He was shocked, surprised that they didn't get it.
Yeah, you can see so many parallels between those two stories, because how much evidence do they have of Jesus in Nazareth? I mean, he's been there for 30 years, and he hasn't done miracles the whole time, but he started to, and yet they still totally, like, is this the carpenter's kid? Like, this isn't what should be happening. Like, and then they totally reject him, whereas how much evidence does the centurion have? Word of mouth, not very much. He's thinking he hasn't even seen Jesus. So it's neat to see the two different astonishments of Jesus. I have so much evidence and yet I still reject him, or I don't have much evidence and look at how much faith I have in him. Sir?
I think what is really astonishing is the Old Testament and how it points to Jesus, and how not only do they have they have everybody that wrote about it. They should have been looking for this kind of person, but yet they couldn't say it. And yet here's a guy from a foreign country. When it talks about that all the world will be blessed, you know, it's talking about this centurion because it points to us, and we're not Jews. But yet there's no reason for him to understand who Jesus is and who is sending him more than the Jews.
Yeah. Yeah, you think this is ruffling anybody's feathers a little bit when Jesus makes this response? I mean, he's probably in the presence of those elders and all his disciples, and yet he says, none of you guys, none of anybody in Israel have I seen faith like this. Pretty amazing. Yeah.
So this is your point. Help me. So in Mark 6:6, when he says, when he marvels at their unbelief, in verse 5, it states that he could not do any great work in Nazareth because of their unbelief. And I think it's important to combine those two concepts between that story and this story, because by all accounts, we've kind of said this a little bit, the centurion did not have great knowledge of Jesus as far as we know. And it seems unlikely that he had the great knowledge of the Old Testament that was just referenced. But he had enough faith that Jesus could do great miracles, and that Jesus did great miracles.
And I think he was desperate enough for his servant.
Yeah. And so I think as we consider the power of the gospel to change lives and to benefit us and those we love, we all need to understand Jesus more. We're not going to would argue that anyone thinks we shouldn't. But the point was, the centurion understood enough, and that enough meant Jesus did great miracles. The Jews knew a lot, but didn't understand very much, and Jesus didn't do a thing for them in terms of miracles.
Absolutely. That's a great point. Patrick?
Interesting.
in the Gospel of Matthew, looking at all the times that Jesus said little faith, it was usually directed towards his apostles. Oh, you of little faith. About 3, 4, 5 times he says that. And he says great faith 2 times. Here, the centurion also, another Gentile woman, where he says, well, even the dogs, you know, get some of the crumbs.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed at your great faith. So it's interesting, if you look at all the times Jesus is with his people, usually it's, oh, you have little faith. But you see the faith of the Gentiles, which would be, to Drew's point, pretty powerful to the apostles.
Absolutely, yeah. So I want to, before we run out of time here, I do want to get this last point in, thinking about that concept of God marveling at us. Mark Broyles mentioned it a little bit during the weekend series a few weeks ago. It got me really thinking about it, about, are you trying to wow God by how you live? Are you trying to make sure that he is marveling at you by how you live? Which you don't deserve that. You don't, are you not worthy of that, but are you, is that what your goal is? Because you're either going to do that or you're going to wow him by your unbelief. There's a big difference in living life like you're wowing, trying to wow God and living for God so he won't be mad at you. When you're trying to wow God, you're not cutting corners. You're just trying to know God more deeply so you can develop a greater faith in him and a greater faith in what he says. And I think that's a really important thing for all of us to think about. Franco.
I think one thing we often notice is the request for the centurion was Jesus to come. But then look at his response later on. Hey, when he was afar off, he sent up. So that's where the marvel comes in, compared to the Jews, whereby they had to see him do something. So that's where you can see a marvel or a contrast in terms of the response of the centurion compared to the Jews who were in that time.
Yeah, that's such a great point, that he didn't need to see it. And such a good thing for us to think about in our own lives. There's definitely been times where you read scripture and you think, man, if I could just see it just once, just that one time where I could see some amazing miracle, then I would, my faith would be on fire and I would really believe. But it certainly can take a lot of faith for us to believe some of these stories, but when it comes down to it, it's simple. Just like this centurion had, it's look at the evidence, look at what you hear. Do you trust what you hear? Then believe it, and that's it. Mark, did you have something?
Well, there's probably only one person I've ever wowed, and well, really, there's nobody ever wowed. But once upon a time, you know, I was seeking her heart, and you're David, a man after God's own heart. And so I'm not knocking 100% about wowing, I get what you're coming from, but I'm always curious about that.
So I guess we won't have time for the Jesus' cross story, but one last point I want to make, going back to the beginning where Franco made this great point about context here, what kind of effect do you think this story would have had on Theophilus? Sir?
Well, it's really an echo of earlier in this letter. You know, it's a kind of echo of Luke 4 when Jesus was in Capernaum and preaching on the Sabbath, speaking to people on the Sabbath, and they were amazed, they were astonished, they marveled at his word. They said, who is this and what authority he has in his word? It's really just continuing to tell Theophilus and explain to Theophilus that people knew who Jesus was and speaking to his character, giving you the first power in his word.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's significant, right, that Theophilus is most likely a Gentile. So to hear Jesus pay this compliment to a Gentile and not a Jew is I'm sure very encouraging for Theophilus to hear, and he's probably a Roman official, so that's even, it's even closer to home. All right, thank you very much for your thoughts, and I guess Jared will be teaching next week. Thanks.